Madam Clerk, would you call the next case for argument, please?
The next case for argument this morning is 153355 and 161123, District of Minnesota, Michael Luce et al. Versus BNSF Railway Company et al.
Very well. We'll hear from counsel. You are Mr. Wolf?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Michael Wolf.
You've divided your time, and so we'll expect you to follow.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Michael Wolf for the appellant, Michael Luce, who is also the cross-appellee on the railroad retirement tax issue. I'd like to, if I can, reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. There are two important issues in this case regarding the whistleblower statute, the issue on appeal, and also the Railroad Retirement Tax Act application to FELA judgments, which is the issue on the cross-appeal. And if the court would indulge me, I would like to focus on the tax issue first. Under the Internal Revenue Code, it's clear that judgments for personal physical injuries are not taxable. They're not taxable income. It's equally clear that under FICA, if it's not income, it's not wages. Right? Long line of cases that say that, that hold that. Wages, in other words, is a subset of income. So if it's not taxable income, it can't be deemed wages. Physical personal injury awards are not subject to FICA withholding taxes. The Railroad Retirement Tax Act refers to compensation. FICA refers to wages. But the Internal Revenue Service's own regulations provide that the definition of compensation under the RRTA is the same as the definition of wages under FICA, except as expressly limited by the RRTA. Okay? So, under that rubric of the statute and the IRS's regulations, income is the big circle, if we're talking about Venn diagrams. FICA wages is a smaller circle within that big circle. And RRTA compensation is a smaller circle within the FICA circle of wages. In other words, because RRTA compensation can only be limited by the Act to something smaller than wages under FICA, if something is not FICA wages, is not subject to FICA taxes, it cannot be subject to RRTA taxes. And that's the case with awards for personal physical injuries under Section 104A2 of the Internal Revenue Code. In other words, regulations under the Railroad Retirement Tax Act can't expand the definition of compensation under the RRTA beyond the scope of what would be considered wages under FICA. It can only limit it unless expressly limited by the RRTA or its regulations. So in other words, the railroads and the United States argument that no, compensation means something more than wages under FICA and therefore it comprehends payments on personal injury rewards is not possible under the statutory and regulatory structure. And it's really important to keep this in mind. The FELA has been around for over 100 years. The Social Security Act and the Railroad Retirement Act and the FICA have been around for many, many decades. In all of that time, no one has ever thought, argued, considered, said that payments on FELA judgments are subject to withholding under the RRTA. Never been an issue. Until around 2013, when the railroad starts making that argument for the first time, in a case in Nebraska and a case in Iowa, and then eventually in Missouri in the Mickey case, and then in the Eastern District of Missouri in the Cowden case. There's been no change in the regulation. There hasn't been any notice by the IRS saying, well, we're reinterpreting the regulation, which it couldn't do because it already has a regulation that says that compensation under the RRTA is a limited subset of wages under FICA, and certainly more limited than income. It's never, there's no evidence of the IRS issuing a letter to the railroads stating that you've been paying all of these judgments, you owe us millions upon millions of dollars in back taxes on these things. Nothing. No explanation for why suddenly in 2013 everything changes. And this is a critically important issue because there are thousands of FVLA cases, and the court, I'm sure, recognizes that the FVLA is a remedial statute intended to protect railroad workers and provide them full compensation for their injuries caused by the railroad's negligence. In thousands of these cases, railroad employees are arguing for the full amount of the compensation that's due them without any knowledge of the fact that the judgment may be deemed to be taxable compensation and some amount's going to be taken out, so that the employee doesn't get the full amount of what the jury has determined is his or her loss from the railroad's negligence.
But here we're talking about lost wages, right?
It's not just lost wages, Your Honor. It's lost earning capacity that's brought about by the injury. Right, so if we could take a different example, a surgeon who suffers from somebody's negligence and his hands or her hands are now damaged and cannot perform surgery anymore, that's a capital loss in a sense of it. Of the surgeon can't perform that sort of work anymore and earn what that surgeon could have earned from the point of injury on. So that's really the nature of the compensation that's being awarded. But even if it is in the nature of lost wages, here's what you could have earned up until the point in time that you stopped working for the railroad, and then what you could have earned in the future. Congress has made clear in Section 104A2 that even if that's part of the award for personal physical injury, it's all exempt from income. And there's any number of reasons for why Congress would have made that decision, and the amicus brief by the AAJ on our behalf sets out a number of and the simplest of which could be is that this person suffered a physical injury that's very serious. That person should receive full compensation of it and not pay any have any taxes withheld from it. And now the importance of the point as to why no one, none of the FELA employees, railroad employees, or FELA attorneys have been given any notice of what the IRS is now claiming as the effect of these judgments is important because the Eighth Circuit Model Jury Instructions, 15.73, following the Supreme Court's decision in Leipold, says that when you're making a claim for lost wages, you can only claim your net compensation, net after taxes. Right? So all of the evidence that's coming in as to what I'm losing monetarily because of my injury is coming on in a net after tax amount. Yet, when I finally get collection on that judgment, now they're saying, well, we're going to take out more taxes again. That doesn't make any sense. It's double taxation. It doesn't make any sense, and nobody is expecting that. The Supreme Court certainly wouldn't have ruled in Leipold that lost wages has to be determined by net after-tax amounts if there was any inkling that, well, in fact, payments on these things are going to be subject to RRTA taxes. Here's another important point. Assume for the sake of argument that instead of the railroad paying part of the $140,000, $45,000 judgment that Mr. Lose received from the jury, we had to go execute on that amount. And let's assume that we went and grabbed one of their locomotive engines and sold it on the courthouse steps and got $145,000 for it. Is the IRS now going to go to BNSF and say you owe RRTA taxes on that? They wouldn't. It would be a nonsensical argument. That's not payment of compensation for the employment relationship under the definition of the RRTA. It's satisfaction of the judgment for personal physical injuries, which Congress has said is exempt from taxation. Therefore, no RRTA taxes can be or are due on this. Now, that really puts an end to the question because it's a simple proposition. It's one that the IRS itself has stated in a number of its publications that we point out in our brief, that if it's not subject to income taxation, it's not subject to withholding taxation. And that's withholding taxation as to whether it's FICA or whether it's the RRTA. And on the RRTA side, keep in mind that that's the FICA taxation provision for railroad employees. So the Tier 1 taxes are the deductions that are taken out to fund the railroad employees' Social Security benefits in the loose sense of the term and are credited for Social Security purposes when the employer leaves the employ of the railroad. Now, it's important also to keep in mind that although we're only talking about $3,000 in this case, we can be talking about a substantial amount of money in other cases. It was around $13,000 in Mickey. It was well over $40,000 in the Cowden case. If a railroad employee has suffered an extremely serious injury and receives an award of $10 million as his damages from that award, keep in mind that although the Social Security or Tier 1 component and the Tier 2 component have salary caps as to the tax, for Medicare purposes, there is no cap. It's 1.45% on the entire amount, on that entire $10 million. In addition, we have the recently enacted Medicare surtax of 0.9% on income over $200,000 or $250,000 if filing jointly. Now, that's potentially subject to that tax also because the taxation statute taxes as of the time of payment at the rates that are in effect at the time of payment, subject to the higher caps that are in effect in time of payment, even though if all or a portion of that amount were allocated to the unique phrase creditable compensation, say 5 years ago when the employee was working for the railroad, the rates back then would have been lower, the caps would have been lower, there wouldn't have been a Medicare surtax, the employee wouldn't have had those taxes withheld from his pay if that judgment were made to him, paid to him in the form of regular employment compensation during the time he was working for the railroad. So the statutes are so disparate in terms of the benefits and the taxes. The benefits and the taxes are so far apart from each other in terms of how they operate. One can't just say, even disregarding the statutory and regulatory language, that just because you might receive railroad retirement benefits, you must pay railroad retirement taxes because the taxes that are collected don't directly fund the benefits that are paid out. So as the Missouri Supreme Court in the Mickey case very clearly laid out in its decision, as Judge Weber in the Cowden case laid out in his decision, at least as to the 104A2 aspect of his thing, of his decision, satisfaction of FELA judgments is not subject to RRTA taxation. And Mr. Lose, in this case, is entitled to payment in full of the judgment that he received from the jury in this case. Now, moving on to, unless Your Honors had any particular questions on that, moving on briefly to the Whistleblower Act. The issue there is when the statute provides that the employee has a right of action if his termination is due in whole or in part to protected activity, and the railroad's attempt at a justification for the termination has to be by clear and convincing evidence, whether the railroad can get a summary judgment, as happened in this case on their claims, just because they happen to have evidence on their side that shows a plausible explanation for the termination. Because the statute uses that phrase in whole or in part, and this court has understood that to mean discriminatory action has to be a contributing factor only, not the cause for the termination, just a contributing factor. That very generous pro-employee FELA-based causation standard is such that so long as the employee produces substantial evidence of a discriminatory or retaliatory motive on the part of the railroad, then the district court cannot enter summary judgment just because the judge believes the railroad and not the employee. As under the FELA, that is a decision that must be left to the jury to decide. And in this case, the jury gave Mr. Lose everything that he asked for his FELA damages. So that would tend to indicate that the jury may well have believed Mr. Lose's side of the story regarding the whistleblower statute. And I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Ms. MacArthur?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm arguing on behalf of BNSF in the Federal Railroad Safety Act appeal. My colleague will handle the tax-related questions. Just to start off with what Mr. Lose's counsel ended with, the standard in the Eighth Circuit for proving a violation of the Federal Railroad Safety Act is intentional retaliation prompted by protected activity. And a plaintiff has to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence. Here, Mr. Lose did not do that. This case is about the dismissal of an employee who repeatedly failed to meet a core requirement of his job, which is full-time attendance. For 6 years, BNSF disciplined Mr. Lose for attendance violations. His attendance got so bad that in April 2010, before Mr. Lose reported an injury and before he testified at the Gunderson hearing, BNSF stepped outside its attendance discipline system and charged him with what was essentially insubordination. As a result, Mr. Lose received a level S suspension, which was the first step in a disciplinary progression that ultimately led to his dismissal.
The plaintiff here only has to show that it's a contributing factor, right?
Correct.
It doesn't have to be a lower standard than other retaliation
matters. That's correct. It doesn't have to be, for instance, a motivating factor.
What about this argument, though, that Kluver, I think is the name, was similarly situated, and he was allowed to use the ION code to avoid an absence. And when you add to that, apparently some evidence of a supervisor saying, if you testify at this hearing, it's going to be trouble for you. Why isn't that enough to at least raise a question of fact about whether it was a contributing factor?
For a lot of reasons. For one thing, Mr. Lose was not dismissed because he tried to use the ION code and was denied.
Wait a minute. But that, had he been able to use that, he wouldn't have had the requisite absences from which he could have then reached the correct level of where he could then be terminated, in their progressive system, right?
Well, those disciplines aren't under issue here, and they are time barred, but to more directly address the judge's question, the record, we believe, and we point this out in our brief, doesn't actually support that Mr. Kluver was allowed to use the ION code in the way that Mr. Lose said that he was. He wasn't returned fully to work and then able to take off at will for up to 9 days a month going forward indefinitely. And also, Mr. Kluver and Mr. Lose engaged in the same protected activity, which is reporting a workplace injury. So under this court's reasoning in Gunderson, that undermines the inference of retaliation because the disparate treatment can't be explained by that. Judge Grunder, you also mentioned, I believe, a manager saying this could be bad for you. That was Mr. Jabe, who was a train master, and the context of that quote, if you'll look at the site in the appellant's brief, the context of that quote is actually talking about the investigation notice that Mr. Lose received. And, of course, it could be bad for him to receive an investigation notice when he was at the third step in a four-step progressive discipline system. But more importantly, Mr. Jabe was a low-level manager who wasn't even involved in the termination decision. So all of this stuff is basically, I think, spaghetti at the wall. Anybody can point to one or two statements that he or she has heard, but he hasn't tied it to the ultimate decision maker.
I was interested that apparently the railroad sent Mr. Lose an investigation notice for missing work the day that he testified. Isn't that right?
So the attendance system at BNSF is basically...
The
attendance system at BNSF is basically computerized, and it's true that lower-level managers did send a notice of investigation. As soon as it was discovered that BNSF was, basically noticing an investigation for time missed for testimony at a hearing, they immediately reversed course. So it's the opposite of retaliation.
Well, I make the respectful suggestion that that's one inference that could be drawn from this evidence, but isn't there another inference, and that is that there was some retaliatory motive here?
And that might be probative in another case, but not here, where both before and after Mr. Lose's testimony at the 2012 hearing, BNSF had consistently disciplined him for attendance violations. And by the time
That's a good jury argument, but I'm just asking, I don't mean to be argumentative here, but I mean, they shouldn't have done that.
That's correct. BNSF admits it shouldn't
have. I mean, that's a blunder, isn't it?
It was a blunder, and it was a mistake, and it was a mistake that was corrected.
Well, yeah, after the lawyer was consulted, and the lawyer says, you know, you should have done that, right?
Correct.
Well, I mean, I understand what inference you want a jury to draw, but is that a necessary inference?
Well, I don't even think that evidence...
Your explanation, did the jury have to accept that?
Let's assume that BNSF did issue the notice of attendance on purpose as opposed to as a mistake. I still don't think that's sufficient evidence to show that BNSF was intentionally retaliating on down the line of when Mr. Lose again violated the attendance policy by taking days off that weren't even related to his injury.
Well, okay.
And I think just to speak more to that, we're talking about two attendance violations between the time of Mr. Lose's workplace injury report and then the time of the investigation. The investigation happens, and again, Mr. Lose commits an attendance violation.
I think the evidence is quite clear that BNSF could have reasonably discharged him on account of his absenteeism. I agree with that, but...
Well, and that's evidence that should be considered at the contributing factor stage. It's not only evidence that's applicable for BNSF's affirmative defense.
My question is, it wouldn't be inconsistent with that proposition to say there's also evidence that is testifying what was a contributing factor, that it was in other words, in the minds of the railroad in some sort of generic abstract sense at the time that he was terminated.
I think it's simply not enough here under this court's reasoning in Kudyk, under this court's reasoning in Heim. You need more than just one thing following from another. And there's no evidence, for instance, that Mr. Wright or Mr. Bailey or Mr. Albanese, the people who were involved in the final decision to dismiss Mr. Lose for attendance violations, were involved at all in this notice.
That would be an important circumstance, I think.
Excuse me?
That would be an important circumstance, if true.
That is.
I suppose if you said what you really heard,
I'm sorry.
If you said what you really thought, you'd say, we should have fired this guy a long time ago.
That's,
now we're being punished.
That's probably
true,
Your Honor.
Because we made a bookkeeping mistake by sending.
But I apologize, I'm out of time. So if there are no further questions.
I didn't need a response to my gratuitous comment, but thank you. We thank you for your argument. Mr. Brasher, is that how it's pronounced?
Bill Brasher, Your Honor.
Good morning. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here on behalf of BNSF on its cross appeal dealing with the railroad retirement tax issue. Although it may seem unusual for the railroad to be asking you to confirm that railroad retirement taxes are due on an award and have to be deducted from a judgment, but that's the position that the railroad is in today. And it's unusual because by taking this position, BNSF is putting itself in the position where it has to pay substantially more taxes on a judgment. Substantially more taxes because it is taxed at a much higher rate for the employer side of this contribution than the employee. In this case in particular, Mr. Lose had deducted from the judgment some $3,000, whereas the BNSF had to pay its employer side of that contribution to the railroad retirement system in excess of $6,000. We take that position not because it benefits the railroad in this particular case. It costs the railroad money in this case, and it will cost the railroad money in every other case in which there is an award for time lost in any judgment. It takes this position, Your Honors, because it is required to do so by federal law. It takes this position because it is entirely consistent with the history regarding the development and structure of the Railroad Retirement Act and the Railroad Retirement Tax Act in the 1930s, and it is completely supported by the record in the congressional hearings regarding the tax acts in the 1930s and 1940s, where labor, where the Railway Executive Labor's Association advocated the reason for this change, and that was because it would benefit the railroad employee if they got credit by paying taxes for the time that they lost because of personal injury, benefits that would inure to them upon reaching retirement, benefits which Mr. Loos will have because when the taxes were paid, the regulations and the act requires that the railroad allocate credit to him for that period of time that he was off on personal injury. And that increases his benefit and will increase his benefit when he reaches the age of retirement at age 66 or 67, whatever it may be for his date of birth. There is a statement in plaintiff's brief that he gets no benefit from this. He gets benefit from every month of extra time he gets credited with for payment for time lost. Every court that has looked at this issue, virtually every court has looked at this issue, has said the term compensation is what governs when the tax is due. Every court that has looked at this has, in essence, said compensation includes payments for time lost on judgments. The trial court in this case reached that same conclusion. The trial court in the Cowden case, cited with approval by plaintiff's counsel, also reached that same conclusion, and that is awards of judgment, which include pay for time loss, include compensation under the act. Plaintiff has cited the regulation in the Railroad Retirement Tax Act that says that the term compensation has the same meaning as wages in Section 3112A. Except, and they omitted this from their brief, and I'm glad that counsel has advised the court of this, except as specifically limited by the Railroad Retirement Tax Act or regulation, the IRS administers the Tax Act. The regulations that they have promulgated under Title 26 include specifically that compensation is not confined to amounts paid for active service, but includes amounts paid for identifiable periods of time during which the employee is absent from the active service of the employer. They have issued regulations, and as the regulation promulgated by the commissioner quotes, it says the commissioner may provide additional guidance that may be necessary or appropriate in applying the definitions of Section 3121A and 3231E, which we're talking about here. And those regulations specifically provide that taxes is due for an identifiable period of time in which the plaintiff is absent from work because of personal injury.
And again, what is the date of those regulations?
That regulation, I'll have to ask the government for the specific date of the regulation, but I can tell you, Your Honor, that it predates by a significant period of time this case, and it's not a new regulation at all.
In other words, and then I guess the follow-up question is, and maybe the answer is so obvious that I have overlooked it, why have these awards not been subject to tax in recent until 2013?
They have been subject
to
tax.
They have been.
They have been. There has been no change since there was a recognition in 1943 in the congressional record. There has been no change.
What are we to make of the fact that Congress amended the Railroad Retirement Tax Act and removed all the specific language that made it clear that this was taxable?
They removed it in the Tax Act, but it remained in the Railroad Retirement Act, Your Honor. It was just redundant. But the regulations covered that specific thing, so it was not necessary anymore. And everybody that's looked at the issue said there was no intent to revise the law as it existed when they looked at this issue and removed that specific language in 1983.
Why not just leave it in? Why not just leave it in?
Good question, Your Honor. But we know specifically that those items that were exempt from taxation under the Railroad Retirement Tax Act are specifically enumerated. And, in fact, that was not one of the things that was enumerated as an exemption. And that brings me to the 104 issue, Your Honor.
Can I ask this? When I asked, were these lost wages, lost pay, your opposing counsel said, now, wait a minute, this involves a situation where there's going to be lost pay in the future because of injury, and tried to lump it in with the personal injury aspect of this, which I think generally is not subject to the tax, and correct me if I'm wrong about that. Is that what we're talking about here? We're
talking specifically, Your Honor, about pay for time lost and identified period of time. That may be a loss in the past, as it was only in this case, and it may be a loss in the future, where, in fact, a jury allocates, as they did in this case, a specific amount for that wage loss, we can identify it, and that's what's taxable. If, as in Heckman, as in Phillips, and as in Liberatore, they don't specify, the regs are very clear. The entire award is deemed to be pay for time lost and taxed, and that's exactly what happens here, Your Honor. So they have contemplated the situation where you can allocate, and the plaintiff could request an allocation if they want. If plaintiff is unhappy with the system and the tax system that we have, you go to Congress and get it changed. Or if you don't think you have to pay the taxes, there's a process to appeal through the tax commissioner. Not followed in this case.
Can you respond to the argument that was made that the jury instructions suggest that it's supposed to be, the award is supposed to be net of taxes?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's very specific, and that's the 104 argument. In the Liepelt case, the U.S. Supreme Court said you cannot award an amount that takes into account taxes. You're not to consider taxes on any award, and that was limited to federal income tax, Your Honor, and that's because Section 104 has a specific exemption for income taxation and that those are not taxable. There is no such exemption for the Railroad Retirement Act, and I might have to address for just one moment, if I could, the FICA argument. The difference between FICA and the Railroad Retirement Act and the Railroad Retirement Tax Act is under FICA, an employee gets no credit that benefits him in the future, so he pays no taxes on that. But the entire system for railroad retirement is entirely different, and that is, it's different because it's set up so that the taxes are paid so that employee can get the credit for future benefits. My time is up, Your Honors, unless you have some more questions.
Maybe I misunderstood Mr. Wolf's argument. Are railroad employees aware that their FILA awards are subject to taxation? Maybe it makes no difference.
Are they being blindsided
by this in any way?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because if you look at the Railroad Retirement Board website, you will find on that website all kinds of publications that have been there for decades, advising employees who bother to look at the website that an award or even a settlement is subject to railroad retirement taxes, Your Honor, and we have attached those to our appendix. They have been there. They have been there for decades. They are aware of that fact. And, in fact, counsel is aware of it, too. What hasn't occurred in the past for whatever reason, and it's certainly not a reason not to enforce the law as written today, is that in decades past, there was not a recognition, apparently, or there was not any enforcement of what we now think the law is, a law that benefits not the railroads. It costs the railroads money, but nonetheless, we're here today asking that you affirm that this deduction was proper and the railroad must pay its share of taxes and the employee must pay his or her share of taxes because that's the mechanism that funds this program.
Well, again, this is irrelevant, but it seems more than passing strange that this law has not been enforced over the years. The taxation law.
Your Honor, I can't disagree.
Okay.
I can't disagree, but the law is the law, and we have to enforce it as written.
Maybe it's of no relevance. Well, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Ms. Erickson, good morning.
May I please the court? Proceed. Yes. Marion Erickson here on behalf of the United States. As amicus, first of all, thank you for allowing me to participate in the argument. I'm here today just because we want to emphasize the importance to the government of what the railroad is trying to do here, which is to comply with what we believe is the correct interpretation of federal tax law. There are a number of points that have been discussed already, but I just want to emphasize that in order to get to the right conclusion, I think we need to get there are two parts. The first part the district court got right. The district court acknowledged that that under the statutes and the regulations, payments for time lost are considered compensation for purposes of the RRTA, and that taxes need to be withheld. And this court has recognized that as well in the Norton case. So I don't think that should be too difficult of a leap. But the more troubling issue, I feel, from what I've heard you talking about already so far, is this 104A2 exception. And that is more complicated, but I think it's pretty clear when you look at it in context that the 104A2 exception for personal injury awards only applies. And we acknowledge that that means that this no part of this award is subject to income tax, but it is subject to the railroad retirement tax. And the reason for that, I think Mr. Lose's argument seems to be that because the whole thing is a personal injury award, it's an award under FELA, that it can't also be compensation. Well, if that were true, what was the point of the jury designating $30,000 of the award as pay for time lost? The jury did that because there is both a benefit and a cost to Mr. Lose from that designation. He will benefit by having increased retirement benefits when he reaches retirement age. But on the other hand, he needs to contribute to that system. It's not a dollar-for-dollar match. It's not a direct relationship. But there is definitely a relationship between the funding that goes into that program and the benefits that are paid out.
I suppose for want of a better analogy, Mr. Luce's argument might be a bird in the hand is better than something down the road in terms of cash today versus some incremental increase when I retire. But
I can't speak to his motivation, Your Honor.
Well, and I guess it's irrelevant.
but I think if you look at the... As Mr. Brasher says, if someone who is not a railroad employee receives a personal injury award, that's not included in income tax. There are no FICA taxes withheld. It's not included in their base lifetime earnings. It doesn't affect their Social Security benefits whatsoever. But in this case, the mechanism for reporting, because this $30,000 was designated as payment for time lost, it's going to be reported to the Railroad Retirement Board as creditable time. It's going to affect his benefits. There's no reporting mechanism for them to say, oh, but wait, he didn't pay the taxes on that. He's going to get the benefits no matter what. And so I think from a logical and from a policy, and we believe it's well supported as well in the Treasury regulation and the statute, those two things need to match up.
Maybe the best explanation of the Railroad Retirement Act is that it's sui generis. It's one of a kind.
I believe that's absolutely right, Your Honor. It's similar to the FICA, but it's not the same in many important respects.
Oh, well, thank you. Oh, I'm there. You have time left.
No, I'm only if you have any further questions.
All right. Well, we thank you for your argument.
All right.
Mr. Wolf.
Judge Woolman, you're right. It should be the employee's decision as to whether to take a deferred benefit by having an allocation to pay for time lost or whether to take the money now. In Mr. Lose's case, this allocation does nothing for him in terms of any railroad retirement benefits. He didn't ask for pay for time lost. He just asked for the lost money in hand he would have gotten had he not been injured by the railroad's negligence. It seems very peculiar, to say the least, to say that it's up to the railroad to decide whether to give the employee this so-called benefit by having this allocation. More logically, the employee should make that decision by saying, I want a specific allocation time lost.
They're not saying they have a choice. They're saying they're required to do this.
Right, but they haven't been required to do that ever in the decades that preceded 2013. And I represent a firm that has gotten hundreds of FELA judgments and has gotten paid 100% on every single one of those judgments, every single one of them, including against BNSF, and there has never been withholding for RRTA tax purposes. So this is a newly concocted argument for I don't know what reason. And it's important to keep that in mind. Judgments have never had taxes withheld from them in the FVLA context up until the railroad tried to start doing that in around 2013. And in our judgments, they've never been withheld because we succeeded in the Mickey and Cowden cases. Now, Judge Grunder.
Kind of a technical question on that. It occurred to me that even if taxes are due from your client, a contribution, that technically it isn't correct to set it off against this judgment, but rather it would just give rise to a claim on behalf of the railroad against him. See what I mean?
Yes, Your Honor, I do see that.
That's a point I hadn't seen really addressed.
I don't think the railroad has that right under the statutes. To do that, but that's a separate point, and I guess that would be one mechanism by which they could pursue a contribution for what they had to pay out.
It was a procedural question.
Yeah, possibly, but they're not entitled to that. Pay for time loss is not the same thing as lost wages, and that's an extremely important point. The statute, the regulations could have just said lost wages, back pay. That's the commonly understood term for paying for money you lost because of the injury that you suffered. Instead, the phrase is specifically pay for time lost, and that's a specific provision regarding the Railroad Retirement Act in terms of getting credits under the RRA system for compensation in specific months to get you up to your minimum years of service in order to qualify for the Tier 2 pension and in order to get the maximum amount for your 60 months' worth of compensation that's calculated as your average annual compensation for purposes of determining what your Tier 2 pension benefit is. So it's a very specifically limited term. Now, if the railroad and the employee come to a settlement whereby the employee says, look, part of what I suffered isn't just the money that I'm out of pocket and the fact that I don't have a limb anymore. Part of what I suffered is that I didn't get the final few months of compensation that gets me to my 30 years of service to qualify me for a disability benefit under Tier 2. I want an allocation to pay for time loss for these particular months to get there. Under those circumstances, arguably, that would be taxable because that falls within the definition of the statute. But that's not what the jury awarded in this case. That's not what Mr. Loos asked for in this case. Mr. Loos doesn't want any of that. So why should it be foisted upon him just because the jury said, you know, part of the compensation you're entitled to for the fact that your knee got destroyed by the railroad is the money you would have earned had you had a good knee during that time period? That's lost wages, in a sense. It's reimbursing him for the loss of the use of his knee, basically, is what it is. It's not pay for time loss. Therefore, not under that regimen of taxation, if that argument even applied, and I'm not necessarily conceding it does. But let me get back to one point. Let's look at the statutory language. This argument about whether 104A2 applies or not. And keep in mind, even if there's an overt award of lost wages in a personal injury judgment under 104A2, it is not taxable income, period, no matter how it's designated. 26 U.S.C. Section 3201, the tax on employees. There is hereby imposed on the income of each employee a tax equal to, etc. Personal injury awards are not income, according to Congress, Section 104A2. There is no tax imposed under the Railroad Retirement Tax Act on satisfaction of FVLA judgments. It's as simple as that. Unless Your Honors have any other questions, I'll finish with that.
Very well. Thank you for both sides for the argument. The case is now submitted, and we will take it under consideration.